On behalf of the Newhall Family Theater and Mark II Entertainment, welcome to the extended interview of Talking Backstage. I'm your host, Tom Lund. Today's guest is one of my good friends, David Kenny. Before the stay-at-home orders in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, David was working as a performer with the Ned Show Assembly Program. The Ned Show teaches students to never give up, encourage others, and do your best. In this episode, David shares with us the difference in arts education between schools in California and schools in Texas, as well as some of his experiences traveling the world with the assembly program. So, David, welcome to Talking Backstage. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, first question I always like to start off with, in the Santa Clarita Valley, what schools did you attend?
I went to Highlands Elementary and then Arroyo Seco Junior High and Saugus High School, and also College of the Canyons.
Fantastic. So what grade or what school were you at when you first got involved with the arts? What was your first introduction to the arts?
The first thing I ever did was in sixth grade, I was really jealous that some kids got to sing an extra section of the graduation song that I was too scared to volunteer for. The first real thing I did was a talent show in seventh grade at Arroyo Seco.
Oh, okay. What did you do for that talent show?
You know, just some Dashboard Confessional. No, seventh grade was Weezer. Eighth grade was Dashboard Confessional.
We're dating ourselves with this. That's fantastic. So what was the Weezer song?
I believe it was In the Garage.
Solid choice. So then when did you get involved with performing, either in a choir or in theater? When did you start doing performance-based stuff?
My first musical was at Arroyo Seco in eighth grade. I was in Oklahoma. And my first choir, I was in jazz choir in ninth grade at Saugus.
Were you introduced to theater like at a younger age? Did you go with your family? Like, what got you interested to do it at Arroyo Seco?
Honestly, I feel like it was peer pressure in the best way, though.
Sure.
I mean, I didn't really listen to musicals as a kid. I didn't watch them. My sister, who is 7 years older than I am, was in choir in high school. But she was a little older for me to like understand or like go to anything.
So it was kind of there, but not, it wasn't completely foreign.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And so then once you got to high school, what different programs were you involved with?
Oh boy. I went to Saugus for 2 years and I did jazz choir and concert choir. And I did, I was in Grease and I was in a very legal adaptation of You've Got Mail.
And sure were.
I was also in a production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. And then at my other high school in Texas, I also did choir and theater and improv and speech and debate as well.
Now, I know we've had personal conversations about the difference between arts education in California versus the arts education that you had, I believe it was Austin.
Yeah.
Could you share with us a little bit what the difference was, how they approach the arts at your high school in Texas versus Saugus High?
Yeah, I mean, it even starts before high school. Like, my youngest brother grew up mostly in Texas, and he was in his first choir in, like, elementary school, like a legit choir. And then in junior high, they were already doing like all state competitions and learning to sight read. Yeah.
Wow.
And I didn't get any of that in California. So there's definitely an emphasis at a very young age in Texas that really wasn't there for either of us.
Now you mentioned for Texas on a scale level. So it wasn't just necessarily like the Austin area, but it was like Texas as the whole state. They really did put an emphasis on arts education early.
Yeah. I think when we were in high school, there was like a casual conversation about Allstate choir. Like, oh yeah, you can audition.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. There's
like, you know, like two people ended up auditioning, but it's,
yep.
I mean, it's basically like assumed that everybody in Texas just like is always a part of the like bigger picture. Like, there's different, you start in a district and then area and pre-area and Allstate. Like, it's like, yeah, it's like the scale of it is way bigger than in California.
So being separated now from high school for 10, 15 years now, have you been able to reflect back and see maybe why there is such a difference between the education in California versus the education in Texas?
I mean, it's got to start somewhere in like the funding of everything, I would assume. But, you know, it seems like it's getting better. I know one of our friends is a choir teacher at a junior high in Santa Clarita. And so, I mean, there are definitely steps being taken in the right direction that it is more available to people now, which is great.
Yeah. I think I remember you saying that like your advanced choir was like an AP class. Did you get like college credit or AP credit for that? Or am I mistaken? Or was it just, it felt like that?
There were like, in California, there were maybe like two or three different levels of choirs, but in Texas, there was like a junior varsity, a varsity, and then a madrigal group on top of that. So it wasn't exactly college credit, but it was like you were in like ranked competitions for like solo and ensemble and the Allstate choir. It just like there were kind of like grades for it.
So if you had to pick one or the other, which do you think has been more beneficial to your career as a performer, your Texas education or what you were able to experience here in California?
As far as like performing, I feel like getting the bug definitely happened in California, but just the training and education really happened more so in Texas.
Okay. So you moved back to California, obviously, after being in Texas for a couple of years. Where did you go from there? What was your next steps to, you know, being a performer?
I transferred to COC and I started taking some music classes that you were also in. And that really kind of introduced like a new world of like performance to me. And I think that was really influential. So I became a music major and then, I started actually like booking gigs and that really made me realize like, oh, you can actually make money doing this. Like, this can be a real thing.
Yeah. So going through that, you said, you know, you were kind of peer pressured for better or for worse into auditioning for a show in junior high. You got involved heavily in the high school. What was a turning point? You kind of said, yeah, I can make money at this, but was there a switch that kind of went off that said, I want to pursue a career in the arts? I mean, you even said you're a music major. Where was that turning point for you?
Yeah, I think our choir director, Lori Marie Rios, really like made a huge impact on me professionally, just in the way that she showed that music and performing music can really be like an artistic expression that kind of wasn't there before in the just like repetitive, like, oh, these are the notes that I sing in the order that I'm supposed to sing them. But she was very expressive about the art form. And that was really a turning point for me in that regard.
So that kind of goes into it. Lori Marie Rios obviously had a lasting impact. Were there other teachers either in Texas or other teachers in California that kind of had a lasting impact on you as a performer?
Hearing Lori Marie talk about how she performed like around the world was something that really like stuck in my head. Like, oh, you can like travel and be like a professional performer and get paid to go experience things in the world. So that was huge. And then also I think April Dooley was really influential in just, I think just being in my first choir and experiencing like so many people that are all coming together and performing on like one specific piece of music. There's like a real energy around that. And it was really cool.
I think that's one of the cool things about the arts as a whole is we get to interact with so many different types of people and different backgrounds and stuff. And, you know, we always say in sports teams, you come from different backgrounds, but we still get that in the arts. And I think that's a really good point that, you know, I remember in choir, we would have a valedictorian level student, and then you'd have the person that's like, I care about performing, and, you know, all coming together to share that one love for the arts. Yeah. So after, you know, studying some time with Laura Marie, what was your next career move? You said you started getting some gigs. What were some of those gigs that you were getting as a paid performer?
Yeah. The first one, which is very Santa Clarita, is working at Magic Mountain. Was really like hugely inspirational. And also doing stuff at the Canyon Theater Guild was really like a training ground kind of before taking the like next professional step. I feel like just the amount of practice and work that I got to do doing shows there was really like a great base foundation. And then, yeah, working professionally, the first one was Magic Mountain. I did the Warner Brothers Kids Club show there. And then I also did my first a cappella group there. And that really just like blew the doors open for me. I was like, oh yeah, this is like all of my favorite things.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about that, because my background, you know, I worked at Six Flags, and when I was there, I made the suggestion at one point because a cappella music was starting to make that comeback. And I was like, hey, I think it'd be really cool to, you know, have an a cappella group or something like that. And they're like, that's too traditional. So we want to have something edgier. So we're going to have stilt performers instead. And I was like, cool. So what was it like being part of that a cappella group? Did you help create it, direct it? What was your role with the a cappella group?
I came in the second year that it was there. So this was 2012. And this really was the like a cappella resurgence. Like the Sing Off was airing. I think Pentatonix had like,
I think they had won.
Yeah, like 20 years before or something.
I think so.
But this was before the first Pitch Perfect movie, I believe.
I think so.
So yeah, it was, you were probably like just a little before the time that it exploded. But no, I was cast in it in the second year that it was there. And I didn't start, well, I guess I started arranging music for the first time, a cappella music, that summer. And that's something that I am still doing to this day.
All right, so let's talk about that a little bit. What is your background when it comes to arranging? Like, were you taking music theory classes in college to help with that? Or do you just kind of hear the music and you can figure out where to put the notes?
I really haven't taken any arranging classes. Anything that I have learned to do, it's from a performance background, I think, and really just listening to all kinds of other groups. Like, we've done barbershop before. That's like a foundational part of it. Choir absolutely helps. So it's really just trial and error. Effort. Like, looking back on like some of my first arrangements, I was like, oh, those are not good. But yeah, it's the same thing, like just practicing at it and learning from all kinds of different things. And eventually you'll get better at it.
After Six Flags, now how did you make the transition from being in a theme park world to now being in like an educational assembly program that literally travels around the world?
Yeah, so I did a couple like paid theater shows, and then I did a different a cappella show at Universal. And then after that, I saw an audition posted, and one of our mutual friends was also in this company. The company is called All for Kids, and he was already a part of it. And I saw an audition posted on Backstage, and I was like, oh, maybe now would be a good time to get like a steady income from performing instead of just like random gigs. So I saw the audition posted, and there was like a 3-month audition process of like filming and sending videos, learning how to yo-yo.
Oh, that's right. That's a big part of it.
Yeah, it sure is. yeah, and this one is called The Ned Show.
Okay.
And yeah, 3 months later, I was flying to Seattle to do my final audition, and then I got the job.
Awesome. So what's the assembly program like? So when you first started out, what were the kind of things that you were doing? What were you talking about with students?
There was a 6-week rehearsal process to learn the show before you ever step in front of kids. And this is, basically the same thing that we were doing when we were kids. You hear that, oh, there's an assembly today. So everybody goes to the gym and all 600 kids sit there and watch a performance of something. And this one, it uses yo-yos to put a positive message into kids' heads that the Ned message is never give up, encourage others, and do your best. And it uses the yo-yo as a tool to be like, to tell a story that's entertaining to kids and also teach them like, yeah, I may not be good at this the first time I try it, but if I keep working at it, I will get better.
You mentioned that you're a music ed major. Now you're doing this assembly program with kids. Where did that come in to be working with the next generation of either students or performers? What was that turning point for you?
It's just the coolest thing. I've always really enjoyed, like, I think the first thing I did was a summer camp before my senior year of high school that we taught like 6th graders a couple songs, and they like put on a show at the end of a theater summer camp. So I've always loved working with kids and the arts since high school, and to do it for a living for 4 years was, I mean, it really was like all of my favorite things again, just like in one.
Now, I know that one of the programs that you did, if I remember correctly, you went to Kenya for a new assembly program. What's that assembly program? What'd you learn from your time there? What'd you bring back for the students?
Yeah, so I did the original Ned Show for 2.5 years, I think. And then they had just started another assembly, and that one's called The Kindness Adventure. And that one, there actually is like a song to open it and a song to close it. So that, yeah, that added music into all of these things that I love. And
check.
It's crazy. And so the idea behind that show is that it's a show about inclusivity and how each person matters a lot. And it doesn't matter what background they're from or how they talk or what they look like, but that everybody deserves to be treated kindly. And if you're kind to other people, then they hopefully will be kind to everyone else around them. So in the show, you travel to Kenya in Africa, and you record some videos of you interacting with a local village in outside of Nairobi. And it really is like the nicest people that I've ever met. Like going to a tiny village that doesn't have running water, and the second you get there, the chief just openly embraces you and like says that you're welcome. And yeah, so another cool thing that the show does is it builds clean water wells in those villages. Oh. Yeah, so
that's really cool.
Yeah,
so is that something like, did you, when you went, was that something you participated in, was the well part, or is that something that's done like through a partnership of another organization?
They had already finished the first well by the time that I got there. They were working on the next one at that point. And I think now they're at like four wells that are finished.
You mentioned that the village in Kenya was very welcoming, is very open to you. Is that something that you saw on a greater level, that they're that way with other cultures and stuff? Do they embrace that part of it? Are they open with teaching you about their background and you know, their traditions?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people in Kenya are renowned for their sense of humor. So they're just like, with anybody, they're just talking and making jokes and making you feel welcome. And it really is like going and experiencing another culture is like a huge eye-opening experience. Like, if you're living in the same city, in the same state, in the same country, you're not exposing yourself to other ideas and what other people are like. So just gaining that perspective on another culture is, it's huge.
Going off of that, obviously the assembly program, I'm sure you've had a lot of memorable moments or something that stuck with you, you know, almost those like tearjerker, like, not going to cry, but this is really touching and really cool. Do you mind sharing any of those? Because like I said, you've traveled all around the world. What have been some of your favorite cities to visit or some of your favorite interactions with students?
Yeah, I think the ones that really stick with me are in the shows you interview, usually anywhere from 3 to 6 kids. And it, I don't know how it happens, but it's not just me. There's about 20 other performers. You'll have teachers come up to you and be like, I am so glad that you talked to that kid. They really needed it. And I mean, this happens like once a month, like, but some of the really big ones were a kid was back at school for the first day and his mom was there. And I was like, oh, I guess it's a big deal that this kid is back at school. So I like picked him to interview in the show and I gave him a free yo-yo. And it turns out that he had just beaten cancer.
Oh, man.
First day back at school. So just to be able to like celebrate him in front of the entire school, it was really cool.
Oh, that's cool. Promise not going to cry. Oh my gosh. So when you're interviewing these kids, is it something that like the teachers kind of like let you know, like, hey, if you see this kid, pick them, or are you just like, you just happen to pick those kids that needed it?
Yeah, rarely, but sometimes a teacher will come up to you if they've seen the show and they know that the interview is part of it. They'll be like, hey, there's a kid right there in the red shirt. If you could pick him, it would really mean a lot. But 99% of the time, it just happens.
It just happens.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, man, that's amazing. So walk me through, let's say that, you know, you've got an assembly book. Let's say that you're coming to Newhall Elementary School and you're going to be performing the show. What's your day like for the setup and all that kind of stuff with the program?
It was kind of different for the Ned show. For that one, I was a full-time touring performer. So I would fly into an area on Sunday night and I would have, 10 shows for that week. So 2 a day. And then I would fly home on Friday night. And that was 32 weeks a year. But then for the Kindness Adventure, I got to live at home. So I could drive to Newhall, do a show. So that would be, they're usually booked like a 9 o'clock show and a 2 o'clock show. So you get there hour to an hour and a half before to set up everything because you're basically your own tech crew. So for the Kindness Adventure, there was a giant setup that had a 16-foot inflatable screen. And yeah, so that one took an hour and a half for sure. So you have an assembly at 9 o'clock. You get there at 7:30. Drive to Newhall takes 45 minutes. So on a normal day, I'd wake up around 6 in the morning and usually get home like 4 or 5 p.m.
That's not bad.
Yeah,
and then you're just doing the show in between it or whatever.
Yeah, so getting there at 9 o'clock, show until 9:45. And then the teardown until 10:45. And then usually grab some food, get at the next school at about 12:30, finish that one, and be home like, 4 o'clock.
When you're traveling and you're going to different states, different countries, how did you fill then your empty time? If you're done in the middle of the day, then what?
It's kind of a bummer because you're exhausted. So if you're going to, you know, Casper, Wyoming, you're probably just gonna go back to the hotel room and sleep. But I tried to, if I was going somewhere really cool, I would try to do at least one big like touristy thing. Yeah, like I went to the JFK Museum or Library in Boston. I went to Mount Rushmore, like Niagara Falls. Like I tried to do something along those lines. And then for international tours, which we do in the summer, you're there for 2 weeks. So you have like a full weekend.
Oh, okay. So then you can go do stuff.
Yeah. So that makes it a lot easier to, you can actually like rest and go see koalas and kangaroos in Australia.
Well, that you can like drive, from what I've been told by my sister-in-law, you know, you're basically like driving down the road and it's like, oh, look, there goes a kangaroo.
Yeah.
They're just there.
There's signs for kangaroo crossing. Like
that's so crazy. Obviously, if you're traveling internationally, you're traveling to different states with the Ned original show, is it as big of a setup as the Kindness show, or is it just like completely different? You don't have that many things.
Yeah. For the original Ned show, I think you just needed like a table and you had the setup. I mean, obviously like you get better at it as you do it. So I could really set up the original Ned show in like 10 minutes. And then for the Kindness Adventure, it started at about an hour. I got it down to like 45 minutes maybe. But then there's a new version of the Ned show, which is the Mindset Mission. And that one's got more props. So I think that one's about 30 minutes for the setup.
Okay. And now you're bringing your own audio gear and stuff like that to the different venues?
Yeah, we try to make it as easy on the school as possible. So all we ask for is one table for the Ned show, or I think it got up to three tables for the Kindness Adventure. But yeah, we bring the speakers for the Kindness Adventure. I brought an inflatable screen. I brought an iPad that I hooked up to a rear projector, like props in front of the table. Yeah, we make it as easy as humanly possible for the school.
So that being said, if you had the opportunity to do the performance here, you've seen the space, like would that almost make your life almost easier, because it's just like you could basically walk in and do the show because you've got, say, me running your tech for you?
In the amount of places that I've been to, I've probably only done maybe I'll say 4 shows in a space as good as yours for an elementary school. But the problem is that you have just a limited amount of time for the setup. So of those 4 schools, probably for 3 of them, I was just like, I have the stuff here. I know, like it's muscle memory at this point. But to learn a new, even if you have someone like you helping with the setup, you have to like convey everything. And I'm the kind of person like, it's faster if I just do it myself.
No, I get that. We've had a couple of assemblies that have come in here that are very much the same kind of thing. They've got their own gear. And it's just like, I have X, Y, and Z. Should you want it, all you have to do is just say what type of microphone you want. And I just turn it on and I'll leave it. And they're like, nah, you know, because like you said, it's that muscle memory. I kind of know it. And, you know, they just kind of do their own thing. You mentioned that during your four and a half years of performing around the world, only a small handful of times have you performed in a space like this. Do you see a difference in like auditorium space or NPR space? Do you see who kind of puts an emphasis on that kind of availability to their students, and what's that like?
The great thing about the show is that it doesn't cost anything for the school to put it on. So,
oh,
yeah. I mean, I've, yeah, I've, we're available.
I've link here.
I've gone to schools that I mean, literally, like, don't have like one table for you to use. And I don't think it's regional as much. It in California, though, there are a lot of like, I mean, there's a lot of older NPRs. But I mean, some schools have nowhere to fit all their kids unless it's in the gym. Some schools have like a decent auditorium, but yeah, it really just depends on, I think, the socioeconomic area that you're in, I guess.
I gotcha. What have been some of the challenges? Obviously, you kind of mentioned that, you know, you're traveling to these different towns and that. How do you keep yourself energized when you're traveling 32 weeks out of the year doing 10 shows a week? You know, obviously that's got to take a toll on you.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's exhausting, but you are doing something that you absolutely love. So that really helps. You're spreading a great message. So that helps. So it really is just getting in a good headspace that, like, I am lucky to be performing for a living. I am doing something that benefits these kids. And yeah, absolutely. Like, I could write you a list of all things that go wrong. But at the end of the day, like, it really is just being grateful that you're doing something meaningful that you also love doing.
In your worldly travels, as it were, are you getting the opportunity to see where the communities are putting their resources into the arts or anything like that for their students?
You can really tell just in, like we were talking about, the performance space. Like if they have like a great theater, like, they're obviously placing an emphasis on the things that would be happening in that theater.
Going off of that, if you're able to see that they've got something set up maybe for another performance that the students are going to do, do you think that you can kind of see that in the students and their engagement, whether or not they're more engaged with you?
Sure. And it's different for every school. But I think if one of the big things, if they have a space like you guys do, then they are used to the behavior and the routine of going to that space and watching something. But if you're going to a school that never has an assembly and it's their first time, they don't know how to act. They're wiggling all over the place. They don't have the behaviors that are taught, and you have to learn that behavior. So yeah, it definitely makes a difference.
When you were talking about being on the road so often and trying to find that balance and keeping yourself motivated, is that something that the company helps you learn or develop? Do you think that's something that's already inside you? Was that something that you learned from a past teacher? Where does that come from for you?
Yeah, I think that it really takes a certain type of person that is self-motivated and is able to keep track of 80 different things happening at the same time. And there are definitely tools that they teach you to help you on that journey. But I think you just have to have like an intense desire to want to perform, which is something that I got in Santa Clarita and still carry with me to this day. But even that, you have to be disciplined and really focused to succeed in an environment like that.
Shifting gears a little bit, I know you said that you're also a seasonal performer. I know that you and your wife have done a cappella groups, especially around the Christmas time. How'd you get involved with that aspect of performing?
Yeah, so it started at Six Flags, doing that a cappella group. And I had seen a cappella shows in college. So I really liked that, but I never had the opportunity until Six Flags. And then we sort of just, that's where I met my wife. We were both in that group at Six Flags. And then we just really loved it. And we kept the group going and tried to get gigs. Like, we auditioned for America's Got Talent. And we got, a little ways into that. We auditioned for the Sing Off. And then it was really just, it turned into this thing where, and you know this, auditions are not fun.
No.
So if you are creating your own thing, you're not trying to fit into the box of what somebody else wants you to be. So we started arranging our own music. We started performing little gigs here and there. And by the time we were in a position to, we pitched a show to Universal, and they wanted it. So we wrote it, we arranged it, we directed it, and we put it on ourselves. And we did that for the entire summer of 2014. And then I've always done Christmas gigs. And that's really the biggest market for a cappella music right now. So I don't think there has been a Christmas that I've gone home for the past, oh man, I think my first Christmas gig was probably 2013. I think I've done like 20 Christmas gigs like in a season.
Mentioning that you pitched a show to Universal, what's the process like for that, of pitching a show, conceptualizing it, writing it, directing it, all of that? Walk me through that process.
Yeah, we had one guy in the group that had done Grinchmas at Universal Studios, so he sort of knew the world of independent contractors working as vendors for Universal for seasonal stuff. So we had talked about doing this a cappella show. So we met with the people that contract those outside groups, and we had the concept for the show, and I believe we recorded just some like demos, and we put together like a press packet. And then once they actually picked it up, then we built out the rest of the show, arranged all of the music, wrote sort of the interstitial dialogue that would go in between the songs. And it really was like working by committee. I mean, we had started arranging our own music at that point, so I was pretty familiar with it in that aspect. And it was just sort of the right group of people having the right set of skills, like, that we had worked on for 2 years at that time.
So it was more, like you said, it was a committee thing. So it wasn't like you were the one who was doing, I got to do this, 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 and this. You were able to go, my skills are in arranging, and so that's what I'm going to focus on. And someone else is focused on, okay, let me develop a script or a show package for it. Is that right?
Yeah, I had done most of the arranging at that point. So I was working on that. We had someone that was more of like a business strategies type person. So he was doing that. Alyssa worked a lot on getting like the look of it right with the costumes and everything. So it really was like nobody was making all of the decisions for everyone else. It was like, are we all comfortable and are we all happy with the direction that this is going?
Oh, that's really good. Because especially you want to make sure that if, Alyssa's coming up with a look, that everyone's comfortable with what that look is. So it's really nice that you guys are able to talk amongst the group of you and come up with and go, yeah, this is what I like. I'm uncomfortable with that, and move forward with that. That's really nice to be able to hear.
Yeah, we were all friends at that point. We had been working together for a while, so we knew each other's personalities and like what's too far and like where to sit back and where to really insert yourself. So yeah, if it was just like a bunch of random people, it would have fallen apart pretty quick.
Well, that's awesome. All right, so 10, 15 years down the road, like what's the dream role? What's the dream gig, career, whatever you want to call it? Where do you see yourself? What do you want to be doing?
Yeah, I think that my wife, Alyssa, and I, our love for the arts, and both of us really love working with kids. We've always talked about starting like maybe a children's theater workshop or music something. We did a trial run in, I think, 2014 or 15, and we both really loved it. So that's always something like down the road that like, man, if we had the resources, that would be such an awesome way to like spend all of our time.
Speaking to that, if you could give either your younger self or if you could give the next generation of performers and artists a bit of advice, now seeing, you know, where you've been able to go with your career, what kind of advice would you give to them?
I think the number one thing that people are too concerned about is, am I talented enough to do something?
Okay.
And I think the thing they don't realize is that most of the people that I have enjoyed working with and continue to work with, the question is not like where you start talent-wise, it's having the work ethic to not only put in the work, but to really just grow as an artist and as a person. So I think that if you're wondering like, I don't know if I'm good enough, like at this point, you may not be, but if you keep working at it and if you keep dedicated to it, you will absolutely get better at it. And the other, on the other end, is that if you are, or you consider yourself to be more talented than other people, nobody wants to work with you. So really having a sense of yourself and being humble and being willing to work hard will make you fun to be around and will make people want to work with you. Just because you auditioned for something and got the job, you're kind of always auditioning. It may not be for the thing you just got, but maybe you want to work somewhere again. And if you're not fun to work with, but you're really talented, they may say, maybe not worth it. So I think being humble, working hard, and those are kind of the two most important things.
Yeah, you mentioned maintaining that positive energy and that positive outlook and stuff, because this industry is kind of known for chewing you up and spitting you out. You know, how do you maintain that? What kind of things are you able to do to maintain that type of an outlook, you know, this long into your career?
If you're having fun in what you do, that really makes all of the difference. Like if you're kind of doing it just because you're getting paid, you're probably going to get jaded after a while. And so I think really one of the things that has helped me a lot is trying different things. And if you're getting too comfortable in something, challenging yourself to try something else, and you may love it more than what you're doing now. And so I think being curious about different things really helps break up if you're like just stuck in a rut and stagnant. Like, get excited about something again.
I think that's been one of the great things about working with you. You know, you and I, we go back to high school and stuff. And like you said, it's that putting in the work and having fun with it. And that's one of the things that I noticed about you quickly as a performer. You know, I remember working with you to learn choir music so that you'd be ready for the Candlelight Carol at Disneyland. And that's, you know, I think that's really what solidified our friendship, was working on that. But then still, we would be able to cut up and have fun and stuff like that in rehearsal. So I think you've got a great balance between that. And I've seen that, you know, over the last 15 years or whatever that I've known you. And I think it still rings true to this day.
No, I appreciate that. And I think if you're like just nose down all the time, like you can't take yourself that seriously. You gotta.
Sure. Yeah.
You gotta keep it light.
No, I agree. I really appreciate you taking time out to speak with us today. It was great insight into the assembly program and what you're able to give back to the next generation. So I really appreciate it, David. Thanks for joining us on Talking Backstage.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
Thanks for tuning in to Talking Backstage. To watch other episodes, make sure to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Until next time, I'm your host, Tom Lund. I'll see you backstage.